Die 17. Bildkunst-Kameragespräche mit dem Träger des Marburger Kamerapreises 2015, Ed Lackman. Das erste Gespräch führten Professor Dr. Malte Hagner und Rolf Coulange. Die Sichtung des Films Far From Heaven von Todd Haynes wird empfohlen.
So we're going to start with discussing this film and we might then draw wider concentric circles around this work. And I start with very generally, I first have to, I'm glad I watched this film again on the big screen. I remember seeing it when it first came out to the cinemas more than 10 years ago. And it was the first film you did with Todd Haynes. And in a way, when I was trying to go back to, I think it was 2002 when the film was being made, and you had just made, for example, two films with Steven Soderbergh, The Limey, and Aaron Brockovich that had rather a rough documentary look. Now here's a film that is very stylized, that really revels in these aesthetics. So in a way, if I was thinking of being Todd Haynes, you weren't the most obvious choice. I mean, you were the best choice we know now. But why did Todd Haynes choose you? Because he worked with other cinematographers before. And how did this collaboration come about?
All right. So first, I want to say thank you for inviting me to Marburg and giving me this honor and award. I have many Deutscher Kameramann Freund, but I never thought this award would be presented to an Ausländer from America. So, well, is that bad?
You are not.
All right, I'm not. All right. No, I've always been influenced by your culture. I studied in art history. My major was German Expressionism, and then certainly the German New Wave gave me my start, and Werner Herzog gave me my first real job in Europe. So, anyway, to answer your question, I think what Todd is a very, like he says to me, that when he starts a film, he said, even though maybe we worked really well together and you did a good job, I might not hire you on the next film because I want a different experience or sensibility. But then luckily enough, I've now done like almost 7 projects with him. So but maybe I'm at the point where he should hire another cameraman. But he always said to me, the Light Sleeper, a film I did with Paul Schrader, he was taken by the images in the back of the car in the beginning of the film with Willem Dafoe. He was affected by the lighting in because it was naturalistic but not. And I think I've always tended or liked realism, but I also love how you can affect realism and create the impression of what realism is, but give it an expressionistic feel. And that's really what German Expressionism did. They took reality as their base and then gave it a certain kind of mannerism and stylization to express these very subjective viewpoints. So that's what I always felt you could do with a camera. So maybe that's why. You know, I had also done earlier films like Union City, which was very kind of noirish and melodramatic. And I don't know, we just connected and he had a painting background also in art school. So maybe it was that connection. I think it was a close runner with Fred Elms, but it just worked out that way.
Yes. And, I mean, this film, you said that before the film started is a conscious reworking of Douglas Sirk's universal melodramas. I think most of them were shot by Russell Mattey in the 1950s. Now, what I find so striking about the film is that it does at the same time create very much a historical distance that we have to the time, but we also get very close to it. So I would say the normal take probably many people would have to make the film ironic. Now this film is completely unironic, I would say. And I think there's also a certain quality to the photography. I don't know if I can quite put it in words yet, what makes this so special and what makes us close to it and distant at the same time. That might have something to do with the way Sirk worked with mirrors and with internal frames, something that you take up in this as well. Could you maybe talk a bit how you would you watch the films with Todd Haynes? Would you discuss them? Would you even do research on how they were done? Mm-hmm.
Partly the consensus or the idea behind why use this stylization to tell this story, you know, because all film language is communicating an idea about what the story is, and what we do as image makers and cinematographers, and we're creating a thematic, and it's part of what the story is how we tell it. And so his conceit was, in 1992, and we feel we're so sophisticated in the sense of sexuality and racism, but are we? Are we any different than we were in the 50s? So let's work with a form that the audience is going to feel like they're somehow could make fun of or feel they're above what the subject matter is about. Like, oh, I'm so liberal, I wouldn't have a problem, you know, having a relationship with a black man. Or the idea of what sexuality is, that, oh, I'm liberal, I wouldn't have a problem, you know, with someone being gay. And so he used this language the way Sirk used the language. Like Sirk, you know, I'm not going to tell you about Sirk, but Sirk came out of the Brechtian School of Theater in Berlin, and when he came to the States, he was very late in leaving Germany because he had a child and a wife. I guess he was estranged by the wife, and so he left Germany very late. And when he came to the States, he had a very difficult time finding work in film. In fact, he said his best years was he had a chicken farm in California, outside of Los Angeles, in Palmdale, I think. And but his friends that were there got him writing gigs. You know, he was like a script doctor, and he got a break by doing these, what we would consider today, they called them weepies, but they were soap operas. So what he did is, in his brilliance, he imbued these stories, these soap operas, with socially conscious ideas about American, you know, middle class society, that he was really making a comment, if you look at his films, about racism and about sexuality. The sexuality wasn't as strong as other issues. And so we're really referencing a film, All That Heaven Allows, but it's kind of a mixture between All That Heaven Allows and Imitation of Life. And because that deals with racism between the daughter and her mother, and she's very light-skinned, so she can pass as white. And then obviously you probably all know that Fassbinder loved Sirk and used Sirkian techniques in his language to tell his stories, and the direct reference would be Ali Fiorit's The Soul. And so, I don't know, what am I answering? No, all right. You're just saying what the form was? Why? Oh, right. So why we created this form, right. So the idea is that it's very mannered. You know, the camera has this lush, teeming, you know, maybe I could say, this is something, I hate when people on the stage read, right? I know. But Todd wrote a statement that I always carry with me, that when I talk about the film, he says it so beautifully that why don't I read it? I'll read part of it. The subjects of melodrama are never up to the demands made by their lives. Community small-town notions of dignity always win out over desire. The dramatic irony is we are seduced by what keeps us from our desire. A description of a world ideally what could be, but is never allowed. The most beautiful and touching melodramas are the answer always lies in what is missing. So we're entrapped by our desires. So in this case, and Cirque used this, he always used the woman as the metaphor for the individual that's being jeopardized or victimized in the society. So he used these visual techniques of, well, one is something we have to realize, he shot these very fast. This was like television movie schedules. Or 18 days he was shooting features in the back lot of Universal. So I really studied with Todd his language, not just lighting and color and the manneristic camera that it moves independently to the characters, but also his coverage. And what I realized is that he would use, let's say, a 32 millimeter lens, and he would move the camera, and then he would pop in on the axis. Like, that's not normally done. Today, we have all the time, or we don't have time, but we make choices visually to, like, move the camera in and move to an angle. You know, today, you know, we have so many choices of, like, how to show something to break the camera line that we use that to make it visually interesting. Like, when I work with Paul Schrader, he never wanted to cut back to the same angle. So he would change the camera position for every time you saw the actor corresponding to the other actor in a dialogue sequence. But with Cirque, I realized he would spend the time to do these moving masters, but then they would just pop in a tighter lens on the same camera axis. So that created a certain feeling. Also the framing. I framed it the way they were framing. It was like too much headroom, too much space around it, because they were thinking of television more drastically there, and they wanted to make sure they had coverage for the television. Now we became more sophisticated, and we go, well, you know, we can be tighter with the lenses, but then they were a little wider with the lenses. So there was these subtleties of, like, how he used framing. And he used the framing, like, to entrap the architecture, like stairwells, doorways. It's always kind of a voyeuristic position of looking at someone that we try to maintain. And the camera only moves closer in really that last scene with Raymond, where the camera moves over his shoulder towards her for this emotional effect. But normally the camera doesn't move that radically in close-ups. There's always something encroaching the frame. You know, there's always another body or part of the architecture. And so that was, you know, we felt that was kind of the entrapment of the character. And your question about the intimacy of it, or I think it's the consensus that people think they're going to go to this movie and feel like they're above the emotional statement of the film, and they get sucked in, you know, because that's how melodrama works. You get sucked into the emotion of the story through the artifice, through the non-naturalistic techniques that you're using. It allows, I've read studies, they think it allows people's emotions. Like, if you go to a cinema and you know, the handhold emotional realism. You know you're being manipulated. Audiences are very sophisticated today with visual technique. So certainly that's been like so overused, what the handheld camera can do and natural lighting. You know you're being manipulated. But if you go to a work of art and you know this is a work, I don't want to use the word art. I mean, I just want to make, you know that you're going into some constructed reality, then that allows you maybe emotionally to connect to the story.
Let me ask a question to your photography concerning the color, the use of color. I see a very accurate mood of light of the 50s and 60s in the movie. Very precise, and it's a great, great work, really. On the other hand, I feel a lot of shots are really something like scary, giving scary feelings. You feel the suppression of the situation of the people also in your shots. And I think the use of color is one of the parts you achieve this. I think sometimes the color get oversaturated, and you used also colored light maybe, and then you feel suddenly that the image is not really true. It's something scaring you and something like a claustrophobic view of the society. So you had a digital post-production I saw, and you were shooting on film. Did you enhance your lighting on shot, or did you do it in the post-production? And what was the use of color in this movie?
All right, well, a lot of questions, good ones. All right, first thing, we didn't use a digital intermediate. Todd wanted the film to work on the level that even the lights, I didn't use HMIs, which I don't know everybody knows, but they're daylight lights that you use outdoors. We tried to use all the technical means that would be available to Russell Meddy, that was Douglas Sirk's cameraman, and Douglas Sirk. So the film was finished on film, even though at that time people were starting to do digital intermediates. So that means later you shoot on film, and then you go through a digital process to do the color correction and to do your film opticals, you know, dissolves or fades. And we went back. It was very hard to find somebody who could still do the film opticals. So the color was, that's the way it was, built in the negative and in the print. It was not digitally enhanced because we wanted to have the same means and have the same problems, because we thought that it would enhance the feeling that you're looking at this world. A way I've always worked with color is I usually work with two colors, you know, an advancing color, a warm color, and a cool color, a receding color. And actually in the pre-production, Todd came up with like 8,000 colors of what each scene should be. And I go, yeah. And then when I got there, I went back to what I was like always exploring in school way back when. Actually, the pop artists use this technique where you can advance and move the frame by the use of color. And it's true. I worked very closely with the art director, the production designer, Mark Freeberg, that I would enhance the color with gels. So many times, like the faces are warm and the exterior or the surrounding area is cool. Also, I'm working with a wardrobe with Sandy Powell. So again, I was trying to work off of the colors of the wardrobe to set them, have separation. And this idea of this, you know, noirish feeling is, that was really something that I think Sirk also worked with. Those films back then were usually very bright. Actually, this print was about a stop too bright. they use very chiaroscuro lighting, very stage studio lighting, very strong lights and shadow. And again, that was like a psychological, you're right, effect of creating isolation for this character. And so that's what we were trying to do. Actually, my technical problem in this film was outside of her house, which was on a army base in New Jersey that was abandoned, or I think there were chemical weapons there. It was the only reason they let us shoot there, because nobody else wanted to be there. Was shooting on real locations and making them look like they were on a stage. So that was my conceit. That was what was my, what I tried to do was to make it look like it was a backlot stage lighting. Where we didn't show any of this here, but Mildred Pierce was shot on a stage. It's a period film, like a neo-noir film. It was based on Mildred Pierce that was shot in black and white, and it was a film noir. But we tried to shoot that as if that was a naturalistic film shot today, but looked like it was shot in the 20s, or not 20s, the 40s?
Late
30s. Late 30s. So that was the opposite problem, that I was on a stage and made it look like, or tried to make it look like it was naturalistic. So this problem was, how do I make it look artificial, you know, with the lighting? You know, like, when I say artificial, like, you could stand next to a light, but there's another light coming from another source giving a shadow of that light on the wall, you know? So I was, that was kind of hard for me, because that's everything I never want to do, you know, was to make film. I never want the viewer, most of the cameramen here probably feel the same way. I never want the viewer to feel the light. I want them to feel like the light is emanating from the natural sources or wherever you might be. And here I was making a conscious decision to make the light feel slightly staged, a little off, you know, that it wasn't real. I didn't go as far to have double shadows, though.
Maybe, I mean, you said a little bit about your collaboration with the costume and production design, but how did, maybe talking a bit more about the production, was it for you said that Todd Haynes had ideas for every scene, so how did you kind of narrow that down, and there seemed to be a certain, that there were greenish scenes when the characters were more under pressure and so on, and these lush outdoor scenes in the beginning when the world seemed to be okay. So how did that color, what would be the color scheme here, and how did that develop? Did that develop during the shooting, or was it a longer preparation process in which this came about?
Well, I'll say Todd is probably the most prepared director I've ever worked with. So he comes in with a shot list. He's gone through the whole film in his head, and he's written out every shot. So I really don't have much say with the shots other than how to implement them. He doesn't always know how to do it, but he certainly knows what he wants. Which sometimes becomes a complication, because then he gets involved in how to do it. But generally, I have a very good crew that can work with them without me. But in the sense of really what the color was, of course, he had a large input with the production designer about the color in the set. But I really did the lighting and thought about what you're talking about at night. I tried to do something where, as their relationship is disintegrating, I made the night like, I call it periwinkle, like a purple blue in the early part of the film. And as the relationship disintegrates, I made the night more acid, like an acid green blue, acerbic. And then I tried something else. Now, all these things, you know, you kind of think, but, you know, you don't really know if it's going to work or not. But the gardener, Raymond, the black gardener, I put him in natural colors. I put him in primary oranges, yellows, greens, because he's part of nature. But when Frank goes to the bar, he's in secondary colors. He's in magentas, pinks, greens. So this is all like my own head trip, you know, like that Frank is not in natural colors because homosexuality is seen as an aberration in the 50s. But Raymond, you know, because he goes out to the, you know, gives her this tree or the stem of the flowers. And so it's kitsch, but that's... I played with those ideas. But I didn't explain that to Todd, because sometimes you explain things to directors and then they say, oh, no, I didn't want that. Oh, you should do it this way. So even like actors, many times actors don't tell the director what they're doing, you know, because if they do, then they'll get in big problems. So just do it.
So the colors...
For no director.
The colors would take the moral position of the 50s, you would say.
I tried.
Just like it's yeah, kind of, you have this...
That was my conceit. That's what I was... that was my head trip.
Another example of very interesting work with colors is the movie we have seen this morning, Paradies Hoffnung, Paradise Hope.
Oh.
In the morning. Yeah, we saw it. Because then you worked with very bright white lights.
Mm-hmm.
It's a claustrophobic place as well.
Yeah.
With these girls trying to get less fat. And but very similar to this movie now, this bright light, this high key, which should give an optimistic,
right,
friendly situation, turns into the opposite.
Uh-huh.
It turns into a very deep and making anxious situation. And you underline it with a very strong symmetric photography. All the pictures are very strong.
Well, I have to give credit to Ulrich Seidel. When you work with Ulrich Seidel, those frames are Ulrich Seidel.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, but that's his language. And then the handhold is Wolfgang Thaler. So I'm really a guest worker there. You know, they don't need me. We're just friends. And so they want to have me around. But what I said in a kiddingly way in Berlin was, we were on a panel and they asked, how do you work with two cameramen? I said, well, easy. Ulrich always gets his way, because if he wants something that I don't like, he just has Wolfgang doing it. If Wolfgang doesn't like it, then I do it. So he always got his way, you know, but... It was just, no. The funny part about Ulrich is, when I started to play with color temperature, and that's another way to get color in a scene, is playing with how film responds to daylight or tungsten, you know, light inside, or fluorescent. And I love that. In fact, I would say I was inspired early on by the work of Robbie Muller and Wim Wenders in their early films like Amerikanische Freund. And they were referencing, you know, the 70s photographers like Mitch Epstein and Len Gentile. They were the medium format photographers that were shooting, Joel Meyerowitz, that were shooting in reality but playing with color temperature. That's... Film sees color a certain way because of the way the film is balanced, and if you use other light sources that aren't that color, it affects how it looks. And I always felt, again, that was a device to create a psychological feeling towards the subject, towards the story, and towards the characters. So I always try to play with that or like that. So when I did that with Ulrich in the beginning, I used to go in the lab, because the way Ulrich shoots, he shoots for like 2 or 3 days, one scene, and then he prepares. There's no continuity of time That's why his films take 2 or 3 years to shoot, because he wants to shoot where the actors are in their emotions. He then develops a story out of what's happening with the actors. Very unusual, you know, because he has conceptual ideas of what the situations can be, but only when you shoot one scene does he know what the next scene is going to be or should be. So that always gave me time to go into the lab to, and back then, you know, he always shoots at 16 millimeter. I could time the print, so I could play with color a little. And when he would look at it in the first week, he said, I know to the producer, I think what Ed's doing looks too Hollywood. And I didn't think I was doing Hollywood at all. I thought that was my take of what Vienna looks like, at least that segment of Vienna. And then he finally said, no, it's all right. So the up story of that is, after we finished the trilogy, a book came out. He made a book of the images, which is fine with me. He took the credit from, and it's not just me, it's Wolfgang. Wolfgang's the operator and the DP. So he came up to me at the opening in Berlin, and he said, oh, you're not going to like the way the photographs look. And I said, no, that's the way you saw it. It's fine. And then I went into the exhibit, and he took all the color out of the photographs. So everything looks kind of gray. And I know that's the way he sees the world. Everybody sees their own world differently. You know, I even think countries see color differently. Like, I always think French films are a little cool, and American films are always too warm. You know, because that's the way they see light and color. And it, interesting enough, when I shot one film in England, which I always thought, how do they get that kind of light? They always had this hard edge, and then, you know, Michael Saracen lighting and Peter Shazitsky, you know, there's always had this stylized daylight look. You know, there's a high light on one side and then it falls off into a deep shadow. Well, I figured out why. You don't have light after about 2 o'clock in England because it's so overcast. So they had to make their own daylight, and they stylized the way light looks in daylight. Anyway.
All right, maybe one question, and then we can also start to open up. We've now talked quite a lot about color, and this is something that I would say is really something that one can find all across most of the films you've photographed. I mean, now rewatching Far From Heaven, I thought, and I mean, you might want to talk about what is really your contribution or Todd Haynes. I found it quite interesting how sparingly close-ups are used, how at some points where you would expect it, like when that hands meet, you don't have a close-up of their hand, right? You keep your distance, so to speak. And I had the idea, because there are several scenes where all of a sudden you realize somebody else is watching the characters. So it's actually not a neutral look we're having, but we're sharing some onlooker's view, and that is normally not a benevolent onlooker. That is somebody who thinks negatively about what's going on. And I was thinking that's something that asks us as spectators to always kind of negotiate not only our own visual point of view, but also a moral point of view. I mean, would you agree to that, also to the way that close-ups were used sparingly and how the whole architecture of looking is there?
Well, I agree with you, but again, that was Douglas Sirk. Douglas Sirk
and Fassbinder,
yeah, but Fassbinder was mimicking Sirk, yeah, too, or said, you know, that he, no, because what, again, this Brechtian idea of distance, number one, there's a German word for that.
Verfremdungseffekt.
Yeah, I get that. So that idea of distance, but then always framing these people through windows, doorways, mirrors, so they're not left alone in their own frame. And this idea of the distance also in the framing, like I said, that he would do these moving masters where the camera's moving through the whole scene and then just pop in for the close-up. That all gave this effect of what you're talking about, that you're somehow outside, you're a voyeur. The strict Brechtian idea was he didn't want you to relate emotionally to the characters. He wanted that to be done so it was an intellectual idea, and he thought that would work better than creating emotion. Now, melodrama does create emotion, so Cirque was playing with both ideas.
I mean, we also would like to talk about Ken Park, yes. Right? But we also wanted to open it up before we get too many films in, to give people the opportunity to share their questions and observations. And I'm sure there's some questions here. Don't be shy. You've said it all. Yeah.
Well, we talked and got to know a lot about the color schemes, but we didn't talk about the camera movements. And I find it very striking that nearly every shot either starts or ends with camera movement. What was the concept behind that? Is this also a Cirquean way of doing, say, television way of things, or was there some other idea behind that?
That's pure Cirque. I mean, you look at Written on the Wind, you know, the camera comes from God knows where, you know, God, and then sweeps into this house. No, that's totally Cirque, you know, that. This manneristic, and Max Ophüls too, this total, like, again, artifice. It was like independent. It's not the camera's not motivated by the action. The camera is the action, and it creates maybe kind of a literary point of view where there's a point of view outside of what's happening. And so this camera movement. And, you know, Cirque was an intellectual, and so he understood that, you know, what point of view was, and that the camera could take its own point of view to tell a story. So that was totally Cirque. I mean, and then you look at Fassbinder, he used that too, like, especially in, like, his later films, like Querel, right? Yeah, yeah. Where, you know, the camera's totally moving independently of the characters. You know, he always moved the camera. Not the early films, though, but he probably didn't have the means to do it, but he certainly developed that technique.
You mentioned that your work for Far From Heaven was very much influenced by Expressionism in Germany and the films of the 20s. Can you explain this a little bit, because when I saw the film, I actually expected more of these images, which are not straight but a little bit turned and so on and so on, and also the strong contrast of light and shadow. I would expect much more in it.
Yeah, actually. Yeah, no, that's a good point. Well, when I'm talking about Deutsche Expression, I'm not talking about the 20s filmic expressionism. I'm talking about the use of color and light of the painters, of Kirchner, Nodal, I won't say their names right, Otto Dix, Otto Müller. You know, you're right, there's many different forms of expressionism in Germany. It was in the film, like, I know, the Cabinet of Dr. Calgary, and then in the wardrobe, and but no, I'm talking about the painters. So I extracted the idea of non-naturalistic color, like let's say when I did Desperately Seeking Susan, that was a good example. I was just out of school. That film made no sense to me. It was a screwball Hollywood, you know, film. So then I had this idea of, like, why not create these two worlds, you know, the Madonna world, and create this foreboding, you know, kind of nightmarish quality of East the Village in these abstract colors. In fact, the crew, I had like a real New York IA crew, union crew, and they go, Eddie, this is weird, you're going to get fired, you know. But to me, you know, the yellow and the green was like I was accentuating what the fluorescent light or tungsten light would be in the streets of New York, but I was just pushing it further. And that's funny, I didn't think of that, but I started that feeling about using what the painters were doing in German Expressionism. And then the Roseanne Arquette, she lives in the suburban New Jersey neighborhood. I'm doing that in pastels, you know, like colors that are very soft and magentas and grays and browns. But anyway, Cirque didn't use those 20s film German Expressionistic, you know.
Now something about Ken Park, which is a movie we will see tonight. Do you want to start by yourself, or can I have a question first?
Well, I could say how I met Larry. All right.
Well, look, there are two photographers when I was growing up that I was most affected or interested in. Robert Frank and Larry Clark. And I hope you both know both photographers. Robert Frank, he's a Swiss German from Zurich, and he did a very important book called The Americans. He looked at America in a way that no one looked at America at that time, because everybody thought, you know, the values in the 50s was everybody was happy and he saw another America. All right, so that was Robert Frank, this book, The Americans. And then the other two books at the time were in the 70s, much later, in the 50s. It was a trip he took across America and showed, you know, the other side of America in black and white, was Larry Clark, who documented himself and his friends. His mother was a baby photographer, and he would go out with his mother on assignments. And then after he would leave her and go hang out with his friends, it was sex, rock and roll, and drugs. And he documented his, you know, the people he was involved with at the time. And he became an amphetamine addict, went to prison, but all along in his life he documented this. And this was like a real eye-opener to see someone from the inside documenting his own world. There was such a veracity and truthfulness to it. And then I met Larry years later in Graz, Austria. So we can always blame the Austrians again. So I met Larry at this art festival in Graz, and I said to him, your books are like a film, because as you turn the pages, it's like part of the same story, but a story moving on. You sometimes you would see the same characters in a different photo. And he said, hey man, how do you make a film? I always wanted to make a film. I go, oh, it's easy. What are you up to? And he said, oh, I'm into skaters. I said, oh, I was a skater when I was young. But what I was really interested in was documenting something about Larry. So I asked him, do you have any diaries? Your books are like visual diaries. Did you ever keep a diary growing up? Because I knew he would have these stories of who these people were that he was involved with. And he said he had. So we both lived in New York, or still live in New York. And I went back to New York, and we got together, and he showed me these diaries. And they were, like, unbelievable, you know, the stories in these diaries. So we're both not writers, so we said, well, we got to find someone that could, like, extract what these stories are, and we'll make it like a collective film. I had seen a film by Stephen Frears called Bloody Kids, where one kid took you to another kid to another kid, and then collectively it becomes one story. So I thought, wow, that would be a way to approach this idea in a story. And we'll center it around a skate park. And then we met Harmony Korine. Harmony was actually a camera PA on Light Sleeper, and Larry met him in Washington Square Park. He said, oh, I met this kid, I think he can write. And so we gave Harmony this diary, and then out of that came Ken Park. And then we went and filmed in this town, and we used all real kids, and the parents are actors. And so really, and then Larry, in the interim of our developing this project or writing the project, got the opportunity to do this film, Kids, through Gus Van Sant. There was a series about AIDS, and they gave one of the projects to Larry. And then after he did Kids, he became the great auteur. You know, he was like... Anyway, it took about 7 years later, and we made this film. And the idea of the film was to show what growing up means. I mean, it wasn't about the children. It was about the parents. In other words, we always said if Kids was about the children finding their way, what is it about the parents finding their way? That how adult world uses adolescence for their own inadequacies, their own immaturity, that they can be very destructive. And then the point was in the film that there is a distinction between healthy and nurturing sex, which we try to show amongst the children, or children, they were all over 18, and predatory sex and abuse from the parents. Now, it's a very hard subject to deal with, because are you exploiting, you know, are you using children in the film or using the images of children as an exploitative device to show nudity or sexuality? Well, my point about what voyeurism is, are the images titillating? Are they arousing the audience? Or are the images making a statement about what abuse is? And hopefully, we were trying to make a film about what abuse is and not about stimulating or being voyeuristic about it. And it's a film that's played, you know, around, you know, outside of the United States, around the world. It's been banned a few places in, like Australia, but we've never been able to show it in America except at, like, film festivals. And originally, we didn't show it because we would have been locked up because it was under Reagan. Now, probably we could. But anyway, that was the reason that we made the film.
Yeah. And to avoid this voyeurism, you used a very interesting... way of shooting. For example, I think you worked with a strong color desaturation. You worked also with this yellow tone, but the yellow tone that you mentioned is something specific in American movies. Turns to a yellow greenish tone, which is really not giving good feelings to you. What you achieved is in this movie, which I think is really interesting. To have double levels in each image. The first image is, or the first view is, what is going on, the abuse or the sex between the young people. But the second level then is to mistrust these images, to look down under these images and under the action, and so you avoid the voyeurism on one hand, and on the other you start to a process not to trust the images, to ask behind the images what is behind them, and you destroy the surface of this movie in an interesting way. So then it's bearable, because the movie is really difficult to see for me.
Well, I think my idea was, again, not to use what I say, you know, the emotional realism of handheld camera, but I was trying to use the camera more like what I considered Eastern European filmmaking in the late 60s and 70s, where the camera would follow the action and on a tripod, or we didn't use maybe one dolly shot, two dolly shots, because it was low budget. But it would be like the camera was motivated by the action. So I had a zoom lens that I would make very small zoom moves while I was moving the camera following the action. But also in the editing, I wouldn't do coverage per se. I would use it as one image could be picked up from the next image. In other words, the images were like an extension of the next image. And I could do that because I was operating the camera, so I knew what coverage I needed to move on in the storyline. So that to me was more like the way Eastern European films were shot, that were like naturalistic. I could still use real time, but not manipulated by having to do, you know, reality because it's handheld. And then your question about how I use lighting. What I tried to do is light it as if it was like a commercial. In other words, but these were never images you would ever be allowed to see. I tried to light them in Hollywood language, but like I say, that you're never allowed to see. So I wanted the idea of like what happens behind closed doors that you're not able to, or where in the story do they always cut away because they can't show that. So that was the idea, and like you say, the yellow green. Well, maybe that's just my propensity or liking the mixture of fluorescent and tungsten light, that I use that. But you're right, maybe that does alienate you, that you're not beautifying the image. You're not doing David Hamilton, you know, you're not fetishizing the image, you know.
And you start to mistrust the images. Uh-huh. You start to mistrust the images by this way. This is very important, because if you start to trust these images, you will be lost, because you cannot bear the movie, because you cannot believe in what you are looking at. That was because of the special color you used and the desaturation, which gives really a very strange feeling, painful feeling to the images.
That was Achim Friedrich.
Yeah. Just a small addition, Larry Clark's photo book Tulsa is now in a classic position in the photo book field.
It's now what?
It has a classic status.
Sure.
Yes, but it was published in an independent verlag.
Printing
house by Ralph Gibson's Lustrum Press.
That's right, Lustrum Press, that's right.
Only this edition.
Yeah.
All right. If you have questions, please raise your arm. I mean, I have to say, being also a teacher of film history, I'm just very happy to hear you talk so much about film history and how basically all your filmmaking relates to earlier periods of filmmaking. I mean, we talked about Zurich and Fassbinder. When we were looking at the Limey on Wednesday, we talked about 70s British and American cinema. And you, in I'm Not There, I Can't Even Start, from Godard's 60s through Richard Lester Beatles films all the way to 30s Hollywood. You just talked about Eastern European cinema. So what is for you the role of film history, or maybe more generally art history? You also talked about expressionism. What do you take from these, and how does that happen? Do you look for it specifically, or does it rather come to you?
No, I just think we can't move on in whatever we do unless we understand what went before. And so obviously, you know, I love film because I've, you know, studied it and look at film, you know. And so it's very important to me to understand what went before to move on, you know. And obviously I've worked with some wonderful directors that understand and reference other film language. And so that, like when you work with Paul Schrader, he's so brilliant, but it's always like going back to film school. Like when we shot Light Sleeper, we were really looking at an early Antonioni, Eclipse, La Nota, La Ventura, you know. And so it gives me the opportunity to explore other language.
I was wondering about your is there any way, specific way or different way in approaching a what you would call a documentary film or a fiction film? Because, I mean, with Ulrich Seil, you know that's a difficult, I mean, it's a stupid question to ask, I know. It's a very general question, but I'm just seeing that in your work, there is Ulrich Seidel, which is sort of documentary. Now you've talked a lot about Ken Park, which based on diaries, based on real events and so on and so on. And then on the other side, if there is another side, we have films like Far From Heaven. But then you say, oh no, Far From Heaven, that's realism plus, like a little exaggeration, but it's realism. So if this makes any sense, does the distinction documentary and feature film make any sense to you, or is there any different approach you would approach a project?
Well, I started in documentary, and I hope I end in documentary, but I think all films are documents, so for me there's no difference. In fact, no take is ever the same, the lighting is never the same, the performance is never the same, and I wouldn't be the cameraman I try to be if I didn't understand light from what I see around me, or understand story what's around me. So I know everybody's different, but I know I respond to what's around me. You know, and the filmmakers that I greatly respected were people like Krzysztof Kieślowski. Right now there's a wonderful Swedish director, Ruben Östlund, that makes wonderful films. So yes, I can do a mannered film like Mildred Pierce or Far From Heaven, but I look to what's around me, or whatever we consider reality, and try to extract from that what I do in other forms, and didn't care what the color temperature was of the film, you know, and all framing. And he just, in fact, he even told me once, when he sees a good picture, he moves the camera a little. So he consciously knew he was breaking the frame.
Could you describe the direct influence of documentary cinematography to your fiction film work?
Well, I always think like camera operators that come out of documentary are the best operators. Like when I did Desperately Seeking Susan, I had a friend, Francis Kenny, who was a wonderful documentary filmmaker, and I said, cameraman, and I said, what would you operate? And he said, well, I've never operated a narrative film. I've never shot 35 millimeter. I said, it's the same frame, it's just a little bigger. And the actors are just like real people. You'll do it because you make beautiful frames in the moment. And so for me, the best school or the best place to start as a cinematographer is documentary, because you have to respond And to me, that's what images are about, is the experience you're having with the subject matter in a set or out of a set. You know, and so it's your immediate response, it's your relationship to that material in that moment that you're capturing. So for me, even lighting, like the way this room is lit now, gives me ideas how I would light it if I was lighting it in a feature. You know, it creates a certain look. I don't want to come in, you know, like Hollywood might come in or used to. I don't say they do it now because now they have a digital camera and they look through the digital camera and say, oh, it looks great this way, let's shoot. But before they would come in and go, oh, I don't have enough light here. I better bounce, you know, 2Ks all over there and have Kino flows over there, because they were like insecure about what they would create as an image. I actually think in some ways you look at films now, they look better because they're going with what they see. But back before the digital world, there were very few cameramen that could shoot that way or wanted to shoot that way. Robbie Muller used to shoot that way. In the Hollywood context, Conrad Hall could shoot that way, but not many cameramen could shoot that way because they didn't trust what they was in front of their eyes.
That's interesting, because one of the most interesting thing experience looking at your movies was that you are able to destroy the surface, the complete surface of the image, and go to another point below this image, below this kind of reality, and destroy it, and to ask, to put questions to every image. That's possible because of this. It's possible to understand Ken Park in this differentiated way, and might be this is a quality you got from making documentaries, because in documentaries you don't polish the image finishly. You look what is really happening. And this is interesting because it works in your fiction framework.
Thank you. I'm going to take you everywhere with me.
No,
you can write all you want. No, I mean, I think what I agree with what you're saying, obviously, and it's because I see beauty in what's in front of me. You know, I don't feel like I have to recreate something. I can find what's beautiful, what's in front of me, you know. Like, I don't want to sound pretentious, but like, there's this saying, or this, I read this, I used to have it in my kitchen, and Proust has this line, one doesn't need new landscapes, but just new eyes. And I think that's what we all should seek, is having new eyes to see what's around us. It's almost like it's what's on the surface that's not hidden. That's why it's so interesting. You know, you can have 5-6 different cameramen at a concert, and everybody shoots something a little different. Or when we used to use light meters, no cameraman uses their light meter the same way, and they get similar or different results. And that's what makes our images so interesting, is because you're imbuing your own subjectivity in the image. And that's what makes one artist different than another, is that you're seeing into that image something that they're projecting.
So, talking about images, I wanted to ask, do you like to watch your own movies, or is it something you think, yeah, you can, but you wouldn't do it if there were, if your own movies, the movies you filmed yourself, so, or is it possible for you to watch it just...
I think anybody would say, I only see the mistakes.
this is what I wanted to ask, so...
But I'll tell you one thing that's really interesting. The thing that you least, respect or dislike always pops up. Like, I don't know if the theater owner's here, but they showed Sweet November, one of the worst movies I ever worked on. and they wanted it here because the theater owner liked it. I mean, maybe it's all right photographically. I haven't looked at it in years, but it's total Hollywood nonsense.
So,
and then actually there's a shot in Far From Heaven that they always end up using someplace, which...
You don't like
it. It's not that complicated. It's just she's in her room. It's a day scene. And probably it's all right, but I have shadows coming on the wall that would never be there, but it's artificial, so it's all right, but I don't know why I did it that way. You know,
I mean,
the windows are here, and the shadows are coming from someplace else. So it's actually, there's a shot in... I don't know if anybody ever noticed that. When you have that dissolve at night, and then it looks out the window, and it pulls back, and she writes the letter... You could see the light stand in the shot. Now, digitally, you could paint that out, but back then, we didn't do that. So I only see the light stand.
So you would say it is impossible for you to just watch the movie as itself, just as you can just see it as the work you've done.
Maybe long, but I don't look at the movie. You know, I don't know, not really.
I have a very general question about your artistic formation. I was really fascinated by your formation, by your affiliation with European film, art, culture, history. You as an American, so if I may say, you worked with Herzog and also influenced by Fassbinder, you worked with Ulrich Seidel and so on. And I wondered, you grew up in the United States. I'm interested in knowing how did you get socialized with movies, or what was the context of artistic culture that you grew up in, and who influenced you, or what films did you see? What was the cinema culture, for example, that you grew up with, in case this is important for your work, but I assume it is.
I'd say it this way. I think American culture up until, let's say, the Beats was based on literature. And European culture for me has always been more rooted in a visual culture. And they've had a longer tradition in a visual culture. So obviously, if you're interested in images, you're going to look to what went before. It would be Europe. You know, there weren't, until the, like, expressionism and abstract expressionism in America, there wasn't really a painting movement in America. And then, like I say, culturally, the Beat generation was probably the first real American distinction in, you know, a different form. I don't know. I just, when I studied art history, the images that I was, or the painters I was interested or learned about were really European, you know.
But for example, where did you learn about film history? Did you go to Anthology Film Archives, or
I went to
the spaces that provided?
Well, my father was an amateur painter, but no, I took art history. I went to Columbia, I went to Harvard, I went to school in France, University of Poitiers and Tours. I don't know. I guess, you know, maybe this was a connection to Europe. My father's company was based in Alsace-Lorraine, in, I guess, close to the German border. My grandparents on my mother's side were Hungarian. My father's side were Russian. So maybe I felt I was third generation. I guess I don't know, I felt more Europe. When I was younger, I was encouraged to travel. I traveled to Europe on my own. Every summer I would go to like three different countries. I always felt closer to Europeans than Americans. I mean, I like living in America, but it's kind of verrückt.
But your parents own the cinema, right?
Well, my mother's side, my father had a vaudeville theater. So a Hungarian immigrant, he had liquor stores, and then when Prohibition came in, they became vaudeville theaters. What's that in German, vaudeville?
Varieté. Well, but it's not exact varieté.
You know, actors would do like, I don't know.
Okay, so it wasn't what you would think as a movie theater, a normal one.
Yeah, it wasn't a movie theater. Actors would perform, skits, you know. And then from that, those turned into movie houses. And so my father worked for my grandfather, and then he owned a movie theater, and then he imported arc carbons. They used to be the light source for projectors, actually, and also lights for movies. And so I was around film my whole life, but never took it very seriously until, like I say, I took this appreciation course or survey course in film, and then I saw the early, you know, Italian neorealistic films, and this film, Umberto D, really moved me because it was almost like a silent film, but it was totally connected with images, like a silent film almost, and told this story of this pensioner, and he loses his dog, and anyway, that excited me, the idea that you could pick up a camera and tell a story with images.
The way you talk about Hollywood, it's clear that it's not exactly the most positive place or the place where you would want to be, right? Was there ever a time in your career when you had offers for you made some films that are more or less Hollywood films, but you were always on the threshold, on the border of it. Were you ever tempted to go into, or didn't you get the right offers, or did you also like to have this?
I think I was always afraid I would go Hollywood, so I was. But no, I turned down films like Ghostbusters, you know. I could have been probably much more successful, but I don't know, I still had that romantic notion. I was a product of the 60s, I was a hippie, I still am probably. And I saw filmmaking as an art form, not as just a business. And I guess I was fortunate that I could make a living doing commercials, which I didn't feel that was a total sellout. And so then I could pick films and filmmakers that I respected. I always said, in a weird way to myself, I don't want to work on the film if I don't think I want to go see it. Not that you ever really know if when you work on a film if it's going to turn out well or not. You don't. But at least you know the intentions of the director. You can kind of gauge if, you know, they're going to be strong enough to, like, take a point of view in telling a story.
I would love to see your Ghostbusters, actually.
I've been fired on 3 films.
You want to talk about these experiences?
I have no problem with it. Bad Santa. And I got along with the director. In fact, that was the problem, Terry Zwidoff. And this was his big break. You know, he had done a couple independent films, Crumb, it was a documentary, and then I forget his first narrative film. But the problem there was, a lot of times, Hollywood will hire inexperienced directors so they can control them. And I would stand up for him. And so they didn't like that. And I remember it was a Friday. They always fire you on a Friday night so they can bring someone in on the weekend. So I remember we left each other. And there was the place where it was green and yellow. It's this midget and the Billy Bob Thornton, the Bad Santa are robbing department stores in the Southwest. So when they're in those department stores in Christmas, it's yellow and green, and it's magenta. It's not red, white, or red, green, and white, you know, like the traditional Christmas. And that's what they wanted. And so they said, it looks very green. And I said, well, you could always take it out, but, you know, they're in fluorescent lighting. They're in a department store in the Southwest. So anyway, they always say over creative differences, but there wasn't any creative differences with Terry, because he loved comics, so he was totally into what I was doing. But, you know, they let me go. That was fine. Then my other outing was a remake of The Graduate. Now, there's a high concept. But this concept is they got it all wrong, that Mrs. Robinson. So they did a remake of about her Mrs. Robinson's daughter. I don't know what it was, with Jennifer Aniston, right? So there, what happened there? Oh, I know that this was it. Remember, I said like either the assistant director or the cameraman get fired. So we were on schedule, and he would do one or two takes. And the studio wanted, and actually Steven Soderbergh and George Clooney were the producers of the film. And they wanted me to shoot the film because they knew he needed help. You know, he was a writer and he had never directed a film before. But they had these very strong actors, Shirley MacLaine and I forget who else. Anyway, then the studio told him he had to do more, so he would do like 10, 20 takes. And then we started to go behind schedule. And the actors, like Shirley MacLaine, says, why do you want, what do you want? Different, I'll do it. He said, I'll just do it again. So they buried him. They fired him, and then, well, he fired me when he knew he was going to get fired, and then they fired him. And then there was one other film I got fired on, but I don't remember which one. But anyway.
You have these, sorry, the films I saw, they have a very strong conception in photography. And how do you get along with the directors to convince them to do this kind of way? Because maybe they have a different opinion or they don't agree to your way to be in such a personal and strong way.
A real cameraman talking. well, it's like this. And when I get the script, and generally you get a script when the director says they're interested to talk to you about working on a film, I go in with a visual notebook of different ideas. Could be photographers, painters, whatever, to show them ideas that I have ideas of how it could be done. Now, they don't have to agree with my ideas, but to me it was always a way of having a common ground to discuss what the images could be and how to tell the story. Now, in retrospect, I think I probably lost more work because I did that. But in the end, it probably worked out. Because they either feel threatened and think, oh, you're trying to do my job. Or, why does he have these ideas? I don't have these ideas. Anyway. So, I think right off the bat, they know I'm going to come in with visual ideas. It doesn't mean that I'm not open to their ideas, but like anything, there has to be a consistency to what you do. And so I don't know how I maneuver, or with, hopefully I maneuver with the director, not against the director. I think I've just been lucky enough that directors that want to work with me, and believe me, I don't get that many calls, but at least the ones I do get are people that know I have, they already know something about what I do visually, so they want to hire you because they think that's what they want. like I said before, I like working with first-time directors or directors that have a very strong visual language. So you kind of like implement what their ideas are. Or early directors that are just starting out because they're more open to experimentation. They want your help. And they're willing to make mistakes because they don't know their mistakes. You know, so they take greater chances. It's the ones in the middle that you get in trouble because, like, every weekend, whatever film they saw, then they think the film should look like that.
I would have time for one or two questions, yes.
It's just a simple question whether your attitude, your relation to the 50s has been changed after the work you have done, beyond the fact that you can say, I have done an artistic work about the 50s. The question was whether your attitude, your relationship to the 50s has been changed after you have done this work.
Wait, the 50s?
The 50s. So you're referring to the film we just saw. Mm.
50s. Yeah, so what's my attitude towards him?
How has it changed?
Ob sich seine Einstellung verändert hat, dadurch, dass den Film über die 50er gemacht hat, über die Tatsache hinaus, dass es ein künstlerisches Produkt war über diese 50er Jahre.
Yes or no? You can also come back tomorrow with the answer the end of the day.
You know, I was, you know, very young in the 50s, so I could say something about the 70s. I don't know if my viewpoint changed about the 50s because I'm referencing a certain visual style. I mean, like I said, I tried to analyze why Cirque shot the way he did, you know, like with the camera movement and how he, like you talked about, kept the distance and how that affected the viewer. But I don't know if it changed my viewpoint. Yeah, then maybe that's the problem. I can't say it changed my viewpoint about the 50s because I can't really say I knew what the 50s were about because I was too young in the 50s. Well, I was born in 46, so I could say something about the 70s. The only thing I want to say about the 70s, I'll say it anyway, is there's a whole trend in Hollywood to want to make their films look like the 70s. Why? Because the content of their films in the 70s were very experimental. They came out of like Easy Rider, and there was a much more youth-oriented approach, and Hollywood was on very shaky ground to know which way to go. So there were people like Bob Rafelson, Peter Bogdanovich, Paul Schrader. A lot of these people came out of the 70s with these kind of interesting stylistic films. What they don't realize, which I really find interesting, is they're looking at VHS copies of these films, maybe even DVDs, that aren't really the way the films look. And they come to you and say, I want the film to look like a 70s film. And you say to them, but that isn't the way they really looked. But they know that's the way they look because that's the way they saw them on DVDs or VHS. So I found that really interesting that people want to reference something that they don't really know what it is they're referencing.
I think this transformation of the visual culture, of the media, of film, the moving image, is something that we'll continue to discuss tomorrow. So because our time for today is up, I'd like to thank you so much, Ed, again, for being here and answering all our questions. Thank you.